once again, here's John Lear. All right, John. A lot of questions from the audience, and here's kind of an interesting one from Morgan in Clearwater, Florida. Ask John, if a lot of ghosts from Earth are here by their choice as souls because they know not to go to the light after they die, or should I go to the light? Please ask him. Same old question, John. If there is a receiver and transmitter, then perhaps the light that people see and that trip they begin to take is actually to the moon.
Yeah, it's going to the moon. I'm trying to remember the remote viewer. Oh, McGonagall. Have you interviewed him at all?
You bet. Joe McGonagall?
Yeah, Joe. Okay, in his book, he said he was tasked once to follow somebody who had died in a car accident south of San Francisco. And he found him and followed him, and as he was headed, you know, he's headed towards the moon, and as he got, as the person got closer and closer to the moon, there was something wrapping around him, and something was saying to McGonagall, you cannot come here. This is not your place. You can go anywhere else, but you can't come here. And it got to the point where McGonagall broke off because he felt his very life threatened.
That's fascinating. I don't remember, Joe. Of course, maybe I just didn't ask the right question. But other than Ed Dames and maybe one or two others that I can think of, most of the remote viewers won't do that kind of thing, John. They, or either that, or they don't publicly want to talk about it.
You know, I definitely read it, and I thought it was McGonagall, but, you know, it could have been another of the remote viewers. I remember there was one came to Las Vegas, but that incident did happen, and that's another thing that tipped me off that the souls were going to the moon.
So you don't think we're going back to the moon, and you don't think anybody else is going to the moon?
No, it's a secret. It has to be kept. Part of the, you know, if you were the government and you knew the secret and you knew the experiment, and part of the experiment is not knowing that it's an experiment. Mm. That's why this X conference that's coming up is so ridiculous.
X conference?
Yeah.
What is it?
The X conference in Washington, D.C.?
Hey, I guess I'm behind the times. What is this, another disclosure thing?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
okay.
The big disclosure thing. Coming. Oh. All the UFO guys are going to talk. There's 32, you know, and they're going to influence Congress and Senate. It's not going to happen for the simple fact that, you know, they're talking to people who have nothing to do with the cover-up. You take a senator or a congressman, and even if they got interested, mm-hmm. let's say that they were high-level and had a lot of seniority, do you think they're going to risk any of their seniority to bring something like UFO to the forefront? Do you think that they're going to hold hearings? Of course not. And even if they did, somebody would approach them and say, let's say you were a senator, Art, and he comes and says, Art, look, you know, this UFO thing, I think that, you know, it needs to be investigated, but the guy I work for and the guy who gives you your clearance as a senator, so that you can learn all, you know, this secret stuff, you know, that you know about, he thinks it's all wacko. So, you know, we have to appease him. Now, you know, personally, I think, you know, there should be an investigation. But at this point in your career, I don't think you can afford to, you know, to irritate my boss because you've got your clearance coming. That's the kind of thing that would happen if anybody got any close to doing an investigation on the UFO cover-up. And I know Steve Bassett has very good intentions, but there is no way that anything is going to happen.
Well, John, I can tell you this. I know some pretty powerful people who I'm not going to name, but you would know them. And they have made some really big behind-the-scenes moves to get an investigation going on UFOs. I mean, right into the right places. I wish I could name the names, and someday maybe I will, but not tonight. And every time they get very close, some little hitch develops, and it doesn't get done. Simple as that. I mean, right up to the congressional Senate level. I'm talking about senators.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets stopped every time. That's true. I know that for a fact.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not going to happen.
So they can have all the conferences they want. It's not going to change anything.
No.
But again, like Richard, who I don't always agree with, Dr. Greer, for example, his intentions are awfully good. Awfully good. But I honestly have concerns that he'll ever get anywhere with it, I guess, just the same way you do. Do you think that if, and by the way, Dr. Greer was one of the ones I played the Lear test for.
Oh.
And, you know, he actually, very quickly after it, if I recall correctly, said, well, when I said, if all of that was true, doctor, would you still be for disclosure? Of course not. But all of that's not true. You know, that's
right.
Roughly what he said. Back to the light for a moment. We never answered poor Morgan's question here. This is a tough one, Morgan. Now we're asking John Lear's opinion about whether, you know, go to the light or not.
Is that the question?
Yeah.
Well, now remember, it was Whitley Strieber that told me that story, and I related it to you.
Yeah.
I didn't come up with that myself.
Okay.
Are you asking, am I going to go to the white light?
Yeah, would you go to the light or would you go to the dark? That's a question for you.
Well, I don't know. If I had to go tonight, I'd probably go to the white light because I miss some of my friends. And I want to go back to, you know, where everybody else goes, and you see all your friends for a few minutes, and then you get sent back to Earth.
So you think that there'd be, that all your friends are in the right place?
Well.
Is the whole, might as well slam it right here, is the whole concept of heaven and hell, as we understand them biblically, nothing more than a myth?
You know, I don't know.
Well, if there's a machine on the moon doing the soul extraction and placement, then it would, you know, that's a careful statement. I don't know.
Certainly we could, the story that Whitley Strieber told about being in the box was hell. That certainly was hell. Remember that story?
Uh-huh. I do.
That was the most frightening thing that had ever happened to him and they could ever imagine. And I don't remember exactly how the story went, but I think his soul was in a little teeny box.
Yes.
Trapped there for a while.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would seem hell. So you wouldn't, I mean, even with all the knowledge that you have, I assume that you are from time to time invited to these kinds of conferences, aren't you?
Yeah, but I never go.
You never go? You sort of, there was a point where you threw your hands up with all of this, and you more or less said, well, I've learned all there is to learn about the whole ET question and UFOs, and I'm done.
No, not that I didn't, not that I hadn't learned all there was to know.
Or all you wanted to know.
It was just, I could see it was, you know, there was no point in going to a conference because these people are just, you know, preaching to each other. And when I first got into this, I could pull everybody up to where I was because I didn't know that much and I had all the documents and said, you know, this is what so-and-so wrote. This is what here's a copy of the documents. Here's the receipt for it. Mm. And I can bring them up to that level. But I kept going, you know, getting more information. And what is it they used to say? That Lear leaps in logic was what they used to accuse me of. And, you know, it just, they were leaps in logic, but they turned out to be true. So, you know, I was getting further ahead of everybody with the information, and it was too hard to sit down with somebody and bring them up to speed. So I just gave it up.
Yeah, so let's come back to this machine on the moon again. It's pretty interesting, and you believe now that it accounts for some things on Earth. In other words, you already said the machine wasn't perfect, and for example, Mariner's lost at sea. That machine can't retrieve that soul because it's beneath a very great deal of water, which it apparently cannot penetrate.
Even a little bit of water.
Even a little bit of water.
Well, yeah.
This machine may be imperfect in other ways, or it may be by design. How can we know?
Either imperfect or by design. But what's going on with this whole question of homosexuality and what we call the gay question,
yes,
is apparently either by design or the machine is breaking down. What's going on is predominantly male souls are being transmitted to females, and predominantly female souls are being transmitted to males. Now, whether that's by design or it's breaking down or whatever, but that's what's causing this increase, you know, a remarkable increase in homosexuality.
Some suggest there really is not an increase, that is just more people are not afraid to be out of the closet.
That could very well be.
So we can't know whether it's by design or whether it's just a simple mistake.
Correct.
Either way, you're actually seeing cross-matched souls.
That's what's happening, yeah.
Do you know that the same way you know about the fact that we're an experiment?
Well, you just figure it out. Take the facts and figure it out. I mean, you know, nobody has to tell you that.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, if you accept one, then why not the other?
It's the old Occam's razor. Which is the more plausible? Did the moon emerge from the Pacific Ocean and go out there and establish itself in perfect rotational lock? I don't think so. Did it cruise along and get caught by Earth's gravitational pull and establish itself in perfect rotational lock? I don't think so. There has to be another reason. And that's because somebody towed it there and put it into rotational lock.
And so you believe it was put there for the specific purpose of engendering this experiment.
That's what I think.
That others might just call creation. Where do you think, John, that the Bible fits into all of this? I mean, the Bible has a very specific way it describes our creation that most Christians buy into. How did that come to pass, do you think, in the scheme of all this?
Well, I think it's all part of the rules and regulations, so we won't hurt ourselves. And somebody on the Fantastic Forum mentioned that, it certainly isn't doing a very good job, and I have to agree with that, but apparently that was the intent.
Well, we've been warring quite a bit, killing each other with regularity.
Yeah, but we've been killing ourselves for God, right?
Yeah, we always, when we do it, when we have wars, of course, we always, all of us, hold the book and God's name out in front of the battle. There's no question about it. Yeah. Always in God's name.
Yeah.
War is always on both sides. So that's true. A part of the plan, do you think, John?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Back to Richard Hoagland for a moment. He is, of course, taking big-time hits right now. How much of what Richard says do you buy? In what areas do you disagree with him?
The area I disagree is a couple of weeks ago he was on some program, and I heard something about, he was discussing the problems we were having with Spirit Rover. And he mentioned that there may be a group that could hijack NASA's antenna and send spurious signals to Mars.
I mean, uh-huh.
That is absolute BS. NASA is doing those spurious signals. They're the ones that are creating the problems. Those signals first go to Canberra, then I think they go to Pine Gap, and then I thought I saw a diagram where they went into Northern California and then back down to JPL. But whatever the scenario, those signals and photographs and everything are tampered with and made just like they want before they get to JPL. Now, the problem with Richard is he knows those guys and what a great team they are, and they are. They have no idea that those signals are being tampered before they get to JPL.
Hey, John, if we were seeing untampered with photographs, what would we be seeing?
Well, I don't know. Where Spirit Rover is allegedly now, not much more. I'd like to see it go down to Tithonia. I'd like to see it to go to Sidonia. I'd like to see it go to that monument that that McMonagle visited when they took him to the three or to the seven coordinate points on Mars. He thought it was on Earth, and he saw all this weird stuff. And then in the debriefing, they told him, no, that was Mars. And he said, my gosh, you know, and he saw these things. And what was so interesting about the book is somehow somebody had sent me those exact eight photographs, like about maybe 8 years before. And I pulled them out. And I said, I wonder if these are the same ones. And they were the same ones of the places he went. And there's one of the places he went on Mars that has a huge type Washington Monument, but only much, much bigger. And, you know, I'd like to see Spirit Rover go there.
You know what NASA says, John? They say, you know, if any of the stuff that Hoagland talks about or others wish were there, was really there, that we would go berserk. We'd release the photographs and we'd get funding we never dreamed about for a manned mission to Mars. The whole world would want to investigate the possibility of a civilization or life, intelligent life, ever having been on Mars. It would be the best thing that ever happened to NASA. Keep it quiet. Not in a million years. That's what they say.
Good story. But what they really do is they seek out government disinformation artists. By first of all, they have to have a PhD and be extremely knowledgeable on many subjects. Then they have to be extremely well-spoken. Then they have to exude confidence and congeniality. Mm-hmm. And when they mix with the public, they do exactly what you just said. Oh, and Sagan used to do the same thing. Oh, gosh, wouldn't it be just, it would be great if we could just meet an alien. But, you know, the facts are, it's too far away, and they aren't here. But you know, it would be great.
But that is a good story. I mean, it's a good story.
It's a great story. I mean, you know, but those are not what's going on.
Do you think they know that? Do you think that the NASA guys that are saying these things know that? Really? I mean, Richard says that the lower level technicians below the very top, they don't know any of this. You know, they're at consoles doing work. They don't see anything tampered with or any of the rest of that. They're good, faithful employees. And even the PR guys, you know?
Yeah, usually they don't know. And I told you the story when Bob and I went down to Los Angeles to meet with the head of Viking Imaging. And I forget his name, and I keep ready to look it up, but I don't know, whatever it was, he was head of Viking Image, and what Bob had seen on the up at the test site was close-ups of the pyramids in Cydonia, and he saw doors and windows, and obviously somebody lived there. So we went down to pick up Bob's race car, and while we were there, we drove over into a JPL, and we walked up to see this guy, I wish I could remember his name, and we sat down and talked with him.
Once again, here's John Lear. He's read lots of secret documents. I don't know. He's certainly got information confirming what these documents say from very high places. For example, General Doolittle. But we're off in some wild country here. We were talking about NASA and how they and what they say, and certainly it is a good story. I mean, it does seem to me, John, as though, gosh, if they had something like that, they'd have all the money they needed to go investigate and all the rest of it. But you're suggesting that at a higher level, they already know and have known for a long time what's there and what it means to humanity, and we can't be told about it.
And before I answer that, Art, I just wanted to tell you that Bad Boy at the Fantastic Forum says hello.
You bet.
Now, as to what NASA knows, they know everything. I mean, they know Venus is a normal planet like Earth. It doesn't have all that you know, glowing hot molten lava and 90 bars of pressure, and you know, it's ridiculous. They know everything on the that's on the moon. They know Mars. You know, for all I know, and I certainly at one time did think that we already had some kind of a base on Mars. And the reason I thought that is I was going to get to talk to somebody who went there. Now, when you go either to the moon or these supposed bases we have on the moon or Mars, it's a one-way trip. You cannot come back because they don't want any chance of anybody finding out about it. And for some reason, this guy had come back, and I was going to get a chance to talk to him. He lived in, south of San Francisco somewhere. And we got right down to where I was going to get to meet this guy, and then all of a sudden, called the number, and it was although it was the same number, we had been using, now it changed. There was a family using that number, and they said they had it for 15 years and so on and so on. But they know all that stuff. They know, for instance, the spaceships in the rings of Saturn.
Yes.
Okay, now, the other day, Yankee Yo-Yo posted a story with this message, and it's a continuing assault on Richard Hoagland. He says to the Fantastic Forum, "Hey, you guys, did you hear that Richard Hoagland thinks there's a UFO ticking and purring in the rings of Saturn?" So I wrote back that if Richard Hoagland said this, then it was confirmed by Norm Berggren in his book, The Ringmakers of Saturn, published in 1986. Now, before I tell you what Berggren said, let me read you a small portion of his bona fides. This is Norm Berggren. Mm-hmm. BSME Cornell, LLB LaSalle, postgraduate study Stanford, U.S. Navy, 44 to 46. Thermodynamics with Douglas Aircraft, aero research scientist with NACA Ames Laboratories. Supervisor, flight test manager, flight test analysis manager, test plans manager, reentrance, test operations, staff scientist, satellite systems, Lockheed Missiles and Space Company.
Wow.
It goes on and on and on. So here's what Norm Berggren had to say in the preface of his book about the UFO that is ticking and purring in the rings of Saturn, and I quote, "Presented herein are pictures of an immensely large, enormously powerful, extraterrestrial space vehicle located in the vicinity of Saturn and its moons. These photographic revelations are reinforced by and are consistent with scientific data extending over centuries as far back as Galileo. The pictures have been obtained by the author using simple, repeatable enhancement techniques applied to publicly available NASA photos from Voyager 1 and 2 flybys of Saturn. Having been obtained by pre-scheduled flight programming, Voyager photographs are scientifically unique in that they are strictly impersonal. End of quote. Now, the size of the largest of the vehicles is shown in Plate 27, page 50, as 31,496 miles in length and 2,422 miles in diameter. Nowhere in the book is it said that the object is ticking or purring. Now, we're talking about a fairly large spacecraft here.
Yes.
Now, NASA knows that.
NASA knows that. And then, John, what is our present space program? Even though since we went to the moon, we've laid back and we haven't left with man, low Earth orbit, haven't done it. But we have sent out probes. We've sent what we just sent to Mars and deeper space probes. Is all of this a ruse?
All PR.
It's all PR.
Yeah. That's an opinion. I can't prove that. In my opinion, it's all PR.
Because they already know what's there.
They already know what's there.
And moreover, if we should happen to get a photograph or evidence of something that they're trying to hide, then that has to be covered up.
Look at how ridiculous is it, that Spirit Rover didn't go to Cydonia or Tithonia or the monument. Now, I know that the standard answer is, well, we've got four more important things to look at than,
that's alleged cities. That's what they
say. But here at Tithonia, in the Tithonia Chasma, on the west side of the Valley Marineris, you can go to Project Red Star on the web, projectredstar.com, and see the city yourself. And not only that, you can go to Mallon Space Science Systems on the website. He's the guy that, is in charge of all the pictures coming from Mars.
Right.
And go to this one Mars picture, and I'll give you the address of it. You can pull it down yourself, and you can put it in Photoshop 7, and you can magnify it and see the city yourself.
I have seen a couple of photographs that Richard showed me that made me gasp, that showed, without question in my mind, underground cities. Now, even Richard, to some degree, questions the authenticity of the photograph, or at least, you know, he's not certain. But when I saw that, I did gasp, and I did say, oh, my God, that was a city. That was a city. There's no question about it. If that photograph is authentic, it's a city. I saw that with my own eyes.
Yeah.
So then all this is a ruse, and it's just a sort of a minimal effort, and we're not going to put man back up, and or will the day come when we will be admitted to some further next step?
No, they'll be cleaning out the Petri dish shortly. I don't think we're going to be going anywhere.
You think so?
Except to the moon. This is just opinion, you know.
Uh-huh. But it must be opinion based on something. In other words, you think the experiment may not be going so well.
Well, you know, it's not that it's not going so well. People are, you know, becoming aware of who's running the experiment. And I don't think the experiment is valid if we begin to question whether or not there is a, quote, God. And so it might be time to clean out the Petri dish and start over again. And according to records, apparently every, 25,000 years, the Earth is cleansed.
Yes.
And they start over again.
And you think we're pretty close?
Well, you know, who knows?
Something you were going to say about the Naval Observatory in Washington?
Yeah, I was going to tell you that story that I was back in 1990 visiting my daughter and her husband, and it was Armed Forces Day, and we were headed out to the Air Force Base. Andrews?
Yes.
And we're driving down the street, and we went right by the Naval Observatory, you know, where the Vice President lives.
Sure.
And it said open house. So I swerved in there. I said, hey, this is going to be interesting. Let's go in here. So we went in there and parked, and all the scientists were dressed up as famous figures in astronomy history. There was Galileo and Giordano Bruno, and they all had this little shtick, this little thing where they'd recite a little bit of history.
Uh-huh.
So I'm talking to this one scientist, and I said, well, listen, how fast, you know, what is there a speed to gravity? And he says, well, we think it's, you know, about the speed of light. And I said, well, isn't it true that gravity is instantaneous between all planets? And actually, there's two gravities, gravity A and gravity B. And this guy had a Pepsi can in his hand, and he squeezed it so hard, he drew blood. And I had my daughter and her husband watching this. So we walked around, looked at some of the exhibits, and then the head of the Naval Observatory was out there getting pictures taken with everybody, and, you know, their family would take a picture.
Yes.
And I walked up and said, can I get a picture? He said, absolutely not, and he walked away.
Oh, really?
Then shortly after that...
Maybe he had just treated the poor guy who wounded himself with a Pepsi can.
Shortly after that, there's this photographer doing leaps and bounds to take pictures of me as we're walking towards the parking lot. I mean, it was comical. My daughter says, Dad, what's that guy doing? You know, and he was hiding behind trees and taking the camera out. And,
yes.
And it was just a very odd experience. I don't think I'd ever told you that one.
No, you haven't. It is odd. And you think he crushed that Pepsi can because...
He knew I was speaking the truth.
Gravity A and gravity B. You want
There's
to explain that one?
Gravity. You know, gravity A works on an atomic scale. Gravity B is the gravity that holds you on the Earth and the Earth in orbit around the sun and that type of deal. Gravity A works on an atomic scale, and it's what's currently known as the strong force.
You know, most... theoretical physicists really have a hard time trying to explain gravity at all.
Yes.
Doesn't seem like science understands gravity all that well at all.
Really. Yeah, they have a hard time with it, and they also have a hard time that it's instantaneous. But the story I told you that many years ago that One's the time that Bob came back from S4, and he told me about a gigantic weapon that we had, a weapon that was so powerful that it could destroy a continent half the size of South America. And he said that a message was sent to the owners of the Gray, and we'd established they live more than 1,000 light years away, the people who made the Grays. The message was sent to them, either you help us get rid of the Grays or nobody's going to have Earth, meaning we'd blow ourselves up.
Huh.
And I said, well, now, what good is that going to do? Because, you know, if they're over 1,000 light years away, it's going to be 2,000 light years before we get an answer. And he said, no, they use a gravity phone. Gravity is instantaneous, and if you could hook up a phone to it, you know, you can call hundreds of light years away instantaneously.
That's a fascinating concept. Gravity is instantaneous.
Yes.
We know the speed of light, but gravity is instantaneous.
You know, we'd have no way to measure that. That's why we don't know how fast gravity goes, propagates.
There wouldn't be a way to measure that, would there?
No.
The more
not
I think about it.
That we have.
Right. So the speed of gravity, you can't even say it has a speed. It's instantaneous. That's fascinating. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that before, nor even speak of the speed of gravity, since we don't understand it. But what a concept that it's instantaneous, as in it always is, always was, and always will be. So it's always there. But there is a speed to it, you're suggesting. Yep. Some sort of speed. And
no, it's instantaneous.
Boy, the human mind has a hard time wrapping around that one.
Yeah, like 400 years ago when we thought the Earth was flat and they were trying to convince, you know, the population that was round, and they say it can't be round. We'd fall off. Don't be ridiculous.
So then gravity ultimately perhaps would be not just instantaneous communication, but instantaneous travel as well?
Yeah, that's the gravity wave that they use to travel. And the leaps that they make, according to what Bob said, I think it's every 12 milliseconds. That gravity amplifier recycles every 12 milliseconds. So however far they can travel in one leap, they can do that in an hour, 12 milliseconds, you know, divided by 60, divided by 60.
Do you have any idea of how a gravity amplifier would even work, the basic concept behind it?
Well, the basic concept behind it is they use the gravity A wave, which they extract from the 115. They pump protons into that. It goes up to 116. There's an instantaneous decay. And when it decays, it throws off antimatter in the gravity A wave. Somehow they harness the gravity A wave through the three gravity amplifiers in the bottom of the craft, and these things focus on a point in space, and like I said, I don't know how far that point is, and they pull space toward them. Now, we think of space as nothing, you know, containing maybe one hydrogen atom per square meter, but in fact, space is a fabric. It can be pulled or warped, and with these gravity, if you exercise enough gravity, you can actually pull that space towards you, wrap it around your craft, and then turn it off, and you're that length away.
All of this is possible through element 116, right?
Through 115, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, 115. You know, John, it was either after I had you on last, I think it was, or perhaps Bob's last appearance, but there was a scientific article that they had just for some incredible short instant actually synthesized element 115, and I went, and so did a lot of the audience out there, because I got a lot of emails. Wow, there it is, element 115.
Yeah, and Bob made a comment, I think, to Linda Moulton Howe that he would like to know more about it, and I sent him as much information as I had about it, and he hasn't commented, but he said he would like to know the exact makeup. Because apparently the 115 that they synthesized was unstable, and the 115
right.
that he and I held in our hands
was stable.
Certainly stable. It was, I think it was 238 grams in an arrowhead shape, and I don't know if I told you this. I visited Bob a few months ago in Albuquerque, and we're out working in his garage, and the half-scale gravity amplifier that Joe Vaninetti had built was sitting there in disarray, and Bob said, "You want this?" I said, "Are you kidding? I've wanted that thing for 15 years. He said, "Here." And I got the half-scale gravity amplifier, and it, you know, comes with a bass and the little half-sphere, and inside is the little holder for the 115 and the little tube that pumps the 115 into the, pumps the protons into the 115.
And you've got this? You've got this now?
Yeah, I got it in my office. I'm looking at it right now. I mean, in my den. And, you know, it's just a half-scale, you know, replica. Obviously, it doesn't work, but it's really neat to have, and it's really neat he gave it to me. And I got it there. I'm looking at it right now across my desk. It's in a glass cabinet, and behind it is the original drawing that Bob made for me when he came back and showed me how the saucers worked, how they pumped the protons into the 115, pumped it up to 116. It instantaneously decayed, threw off the antimatter, which was mixed with matter and a thermionic generator creating heat, which they turned into used for voltage to power the craft, and the gravity A wave, which they used to travel in. And the original drawing is framed behind that little replica amplifier.
Boy, what a concept. All right, hold on, John. We're at the top of the hour. So gravity is instantaneous. I mean, just try during the break to grasp mentally the concept of instantaneous and what that means. Really, it means it was always, is now, and always will be, in a way. That would have to be something of the nature of instantaneous, wouldn't it? And that you can use it to communicate and then perhaps go from point A to point B real quick.